On va pouvoir reprendre pour ce dernier séminaire de ces matinées un peu longues. Donc, maybe I'll switch to English since our guest speaker is going to speak in English. So, I'm glad that Björn Sottman accepted to come and give a talk about a topic which has become quite popular in the recent years. Regarding the thermoelectric effects in mesoscopic systems, namely three-terminal geometries. So why three-terminal geometry? So I suppose that Björn is going to explain that to us. I mean, it's not just because three is more fun than two, but actually because the third terminal can be used to control different things in the systems and perhaps in particular in elastic processes. So there's been quite a bit of interest in this, and that will be the subject of his talk. I don't know if I will have the time to return to this topic in the lectures. Perhaps yes, perhaps not. But I rely on Björn to cover this topic. So just a few words about Björn. So he did his PhD at the University of Essen, well, first Bochum, then Essen, if I'm correct, with Jürgen Koenig, and the PhD was about the influence of spin excitations on transport through a quantum dot spin valve. And then, after his PhD, he moved to Geneva. He's been in Geneva for 2 years, where he was a postdoc of Markus Bütiker. And I guess some of the work presented here has been done in collaboration with Markus himself. So, Björn, it's all yours.
Thanks a lot, Antoine, especially for inviting me and giving the opportunity to present our recent work on quantum dot thermoelectrics with three terminals. And the work that I'm going to present today is mostly the result of a collaboration with Rafael Sanchez, who was a postdoc in Geneva and is now back in Madrid. Andrew Jordan, who at some point also was a postdoc in Geneva and is now a professor in Rochester. And of course, Markus Bütiker in Geneva, who unfortunately passed away a month ago. So let me start with a brief outline of my talk. First, I will give you some rather general introduction into quantum dot physics and Coulomb blockade. Then I will motivate why it's interesting to look at thermoelectric properties of quantum dots, and in particular, to look at these three terminal structures. This will about take half of the talk, and then I will come to some specific examples, namely first focusing on Coulomb-coupled conductors, first in the Coulomb blockade regime, then open quantum dots, and finally resonant tunneling. And then towards the end of the talk, I will also briefly say a few things about heat engines that are powered by different forms of bosons, for example, phonons, magnons, or microwave photons. And then I give some summary. All right, let's start with the introduction, and let me tell you a bit about quantum dot. So a quantum dot is basically a small object where the motion of an electron is confined in all three spatial directions. So effectively, it's a quasi-zero-dimensional object, and in some sense, it's like an artificial atom, just that it's much bigger, and therefore the involved energy scales are much smaller. And so a typical transport setup involving a quantum dot looks like the one shown here. In the middle, we have our quantum dot or island, which is then connected via tunnel barriers to source and a drain electrode. You can apply a bias voltage, drive a current through the system, and you also have the possibility to apply a gate voltage to the quantum dot to locally change the potential landscape and move levels up and down. And in such a setup, you have basically three characteristic energy scales. There's the charging energy, which basically tells you how much energy it costs to put an extra electron on your island. And this depends on the capacitance of the dot. Since the dot is small, the capacitance is small, and therefore these charging effects are rather large. Then I already said this quantum dot is like a box for electrons. So since now I have a particle in a box, quantum mechanics tells you that you get discrete levels. So there's also a level quantization characterized by some level spacing delta epsilon. And finally, you have the tunnel couplings that describe these contacts and which determine in which transport regime you are in. And so in the following slides, I will focus a bit more on these Coulomb blockade physics, level spacings, and different transport regimes. Let's start with Coulomb blockade. So here's once more the expression for the charging energy. You see that it depends on n, the number of electrons on the quantum dot. And then it also depends on the gate voltage via some capacitance. And so now for each number of electrons on the dot, you can actually plot this charging energy as a function of the gate voltage, and you get a family of parabolas like the one shown here. And now for some arbitrarily chosen gate voltage, typically in the ground state, the number of electrons on the dot is fixed, like n or n plus 1. So transport does not take place because you cannot add an extra electron to the dot. However, you also see that here, here, and here you have degeneracy points where two charged states have exactly the same energy. So now you can add electrons and take them out again, and therefore transport takes place. And this is what you see here on the right-hand side, where I've schematically sketched the conductance as a function of the gate voltage. You see at the degeneracy points, there's a large conductance, but in between there are valleys where conductance is strongly suppressed because the electron number on the dot is fixed. And so these oscillations between large conductance and small conductance are referred to as Coulomb oscillations. So this only involves the charging energy of the quantum dot. However, we also have the discrete energy levels, which are schematically shown here on the right-hand side. And if you take into account this finite level spacing, the total energy of the quantum dot is no longer only given by the charging energy, but also by the energy that we need to fill the different levels. And for this reason, the addition energy of an electron is no longer only determined by the charging energy, but also by the level spacings. And this is what you nicely see in this upper plot here, taken from an experiment, where the conductance of the dot is shown as a function of the gate voltage and the applied bias voltage. So this plot from the last slide basically is a cut along this line here, and you clearly see these peaks of the conductance and the valleys. And what you see is that here we have different distances. The odd numbered all have the same size, and they are just determined by the charging energy because we put in an electron into a half-filled level. But for the even numbered valleys, we have a larger spacing because now we need to pay the charging energy and the level spacing because we fill up a new level like in the situation shown here. And now depending on how this level spacing delta epsilon compares to temperature and voltage, we can be in the regime where many levels are involved, so effectively the density of states of the dot is continuous and we speak of a metallic island, or we can be in the opposite regime where delta epsilon is larger than temperature and voltage, so only a single level is relevant for transport and we have a two single level quantum dot. Now, how does transport take place in such a quantum dot? In principle, there are three different transport regimes. The first one is the so-called sequential tunneling, where you simply have an electron tunneling onto the quantum dot or out of the quantum dot. And so since there's just one electron involved, it's a first order process in the tunnel coupling gamma, and it involves a real occupation of the quantum dot. And of course, for this whole process, energy has to be conserved, so we can tunnel from here onto this level, but we can't tunnel from here onto this level up there. And for this reason, sequential tunneling is always dominant when we are on resonance, which means that either the temperature or the voltage are larger than the tunnel coupling or the energy epsilon of the quantum dot level. If we are off resonance, then typically co-tunneling starts to be the dominant process, where we now have the tunneling of two electrons, like is shown here. So an electron from the left lead jumps onto the dot and then within one coherent process also tunnels out, say, to the other side. Now, obviously, this is a process of second order in the tunnel coupling. And importantly, this intermediate state here only involves a virtual occupation of the quantum dot, so we can violate the the energy conservation for this intermediate state because it just lives for a certain time t. And as I already said, this co-tunneling is dominant off resonance when the level position is larger than temperature, voltage, and tunnel coupling, because in this regime, sequential tunneling is exponentially suppressed while co-tunneling is only algebraically suppressed. And finally, we can also have resonant tunneling through the quantum dot, where now many electrons tunnel on and off the dot in one coherent process. Now, obviously, transport processes of arbitrarily high order in the tunnel coupling contribute to transport. Therefore, the whole thing is non-perturbative in gamma, which then also can give rise to complicated many-body effects like the Kondo effect, but that's something I will not cover at all in my talk. And the resonant tunneling is always relevant when we are in the so-called strong coupling limit, when the tunnel coupling is large compared to temperature and the applied bias voltage. Now let's assume we have a single level quantum dot and we want to describe it theoretically. How do we do this? Well, this is rather simple because it's just given by the so-called Anderson model, which consists more or less of three different parts. Here we have the part describing the quantum dot as a level with an energy epsilon and the Coulomb energy U. Then in orange, we have the part describing the non-interacting electronic reservoirs. And finally, we have our tunnel Hamiltonian, which transfers electrons from the dot to the lead and the other way around. And so for the isolated quantum dot, we then have a very simple system with just four states. The dot can be empty with energy zero. We can have a spin up or spin down on the dot. Each of this has an energy epsilon. And we can also put two electrons on the dot at the same time. And in this situation, the energy is 2 epsilon plus U, because now we have charging effects coming into play. And so this whole model is basically characterized by 5 parameters. There's the level position, which you can tune via the gate voltage. That's the Coulomb energy U, which in general is fixed because it's determined by the geometry. Then we have the tunnel couplings, which are related to these tunnel matrix element T, and quite often you can also tune these tunnel couplings in the experiment. And of course we have the temperature and the voltage characterizing these electronic reservoirs, and these quantities you can also change easily in experiment. If you want to calculate transport through this system, we use a simple master equation approach. So let us denote by P chi the probability that our quantum dot is in one of the 4 eigenstates. Then these occupation probabilities obey a simple master equation, which you can write down in this form here, and these quantities W chi chi prime are simply transition rates from a state chi prime to a state chi. And if you're in the sequential tunneling limit, then these transition rates can be evaluated very easily by Fermi's golden rule, and we get expressions like the one shown here. So, for example, if we want to go from the empty dot to the singly occupied dot, we have the tunnel matrix elements, which basically tell us how easily we tunnel onto the dot. And then we have the Fermi function of energy epsilon, which tells us whether there's actually an electron with the appropriate energy available in the reservoir. And similarly, if we tunnel out of the quantum dot, the Fermi function is replaced by 1 minus the Fermi function, because now we need an empty state in the dot. And within this master equation for emilism, we can then also straightforwardly calculate the current through the quantum dot by this expression here, where we now have some current rates appearing. And these current rates are simply related to the transition rates by multiplying with a factor that counts the number of electrons which are transferred between the dot and the lead. So this was about the theoretical description of the quantum dot. Now you can also ask, how do I actually realize them in experiment? And it turns out there's a number of ways to do this. You can, for example, use a 2-dimensional electron gas that forms at the interface between 2 semiconductors. And then on top you put metallic gates, like here. And if you apply a negative voltage, you can deplete the electron gas underneath. And in this way, you can form the source and the drain electrode, and this little puddle here in the middle then is the quantum dot. Another method consists of using very small metallic nanoparticles, which are these dots here, so they're perhaps 10 nanometers in size. And if you're lucky, one of these guys contacts the source and the drain electrode, and then you can measure transport through them. Alternatively, you can also use self-assembled quantum dots that grow like little islands on a substrate. So these are these bigger dots here, and then you can also contact them with reservoirs. Other systems use, for example, a carbon nanotube. That's this little guy here running from the source to the drain. And then you can use a gate voltage to control the quantum dot that forms here in this nanotube. People also used graphene flakes as quantum dots. And there are also experiments where nanowires are used, like the one shown here. And then on top, you put your electrodes, and underneath you have the gates to control the properties of the dots, like level positions. Okay, so this basically concludes my introduction into quantum dot transport. So let's now make the connection to thermoelectrics. As Antoine already mentioned, in principle, thermoelectrics is rather old, going back to Seebeck nearly 190 years ago, who showed that by heating up a sample, you can drive a current. And then Peltier also showed that the reverse is possible. If you drive a current through a sample, you can get some cooling or heating depending on the direction of the flow. And thermoelectrics is quite nice because if you have a thermoelectric generator, there are no moving parts. So if it works once, it basically works forever, which is why NASA uses this for some spaceships. Then compared to other forms of energy harvesting, thermoelectric has the advantage that you can scale it down all the way to the nanoscale. And actually, as we will see later on, you actually get even some benefits by scaling things down. And another important advantage is, of course, that heat is something you have everywhere. I mean, that's in the computer here. You have some body heat. So there's basically always fuel for your thermoelectric heat generators. But there's also one important drawback, and this is that by now the efficiency and therefore also the output power of thermoelectric heat generators are rather small. And so the hope that we have is that that mesoscopic physics, and in particular these quantum dots, can help to overcome these limitations here. So it turns out that the connection between mesoscopic physics and thermoelectrics is roughly 20 years old and started with theoretical analysis by the Benacker group, who looked at basically the thermopower of fundamental mesoscopic structures like quantum dots, quantum point contact, and so on. And at the same time, particularly led by the Mohlenkamp group, there were also experiments that nicely confirmed these theoretical results. But at the other hand, people then also asked whether mesoscopic physics can be useful for thermoelectric applications. And the first work that goes into this direction is probably these papers by Dresselhaus that showed that if you have a quantum wire or a quantum well, then the thermoelectric performance is much larger than for the same material in the bulk form. And in the same direction, we have these papers by Mayen and Sofo that showed that if you have sharp spectral features in your thermoelectric system, then the thermoelectric performance will be dramatically increased because you have this very good energy filtering that will be topic of the lecture later on. And now this also makes clear why we want to look at quantum dots, because there we have these very sharp levels. So they basically are this paradigmatic realization of sharp spectral features. And some kind of side remark, I also want to mention that people also looked at applications in the form of electronic refrigerators, where you basically use more or less the Peltier effect. And after some theoretical proposals in the 90s, 4 years ago, there have been some results where people managed to cool a small island made of a two-dimensional electron gas, I think from 300 millikelvin down to 200 millikelvin. And since cooling things through these low temperatures is very difficult, having this electronic means of doing this is of course very nice. Now I should say that most of the results, or basically everything that is looked at here, is thermoelectrics in a two-terminal setup. Now what we want to look at is three-terminal thermoelectrics, for example in a setup like the one shown here. So in the middle there is our mesoscopic structure, like these quantum dots, and then we have two cold reservoirs and one hot reservoir down here. Now, why three terminals instead of two terminals? It turns out there's a number of reasons for looking at this. First of all, there is a connection to so-called Coulomb drag physics. So this is something shown here in this experiment from the group of Charlie Marcus. You have two quantum dots which are just capacitively coupled, so there's no charge current flowing between the dots. Now you drive a charge current through this lower dot, thereby you generate fluctuations of the charge on this lower quantum dot. These charge fluctuations then via the Coulomb interaction are translated into charge fluctuations on the upper dot, and now there they are rectified and allow you to drive a current in this upper circuit without applying a bias voltage. And of course, if you know that this Coulomb drag physics works, you can ask, do I really need non-equilibrium current fluctuations down here, or can I have the same just by having thermal fluctuations? Another nice thing about these three-terminal structures is that, unlike in the two-terminal case, you can now have crossed flow of heat and charge. I mean, look at this system here, then heat obviously flows from the hot to the cold, so from bottom to top, while we want to drive the charge current up here from the left to the right. And these crossing of heat and charge currents also allows you to effectively separate your hot source and your rectifying unit. And this is quite interesting for energy harvesting applications. Think, for example, of a computer chip where you have a circuit that becomes hot, and then next by you can actually put your energy harvester without any direct electrical contact, so you don't get any short circuits or whatever. Okay, so this was basically the introduction. I hope that now you have a rough understanding of Coulomb blockade physics in quantum dots. And you also should get an idea why we want to look at thermoelectrics in these three-terminal structures with quantum dots. Okay, so now I want to come to certain concrete realizations based on Coulomb-coupled conductors. And we start again with this picture, which is from a work by Rafael Sanchez and Marcus Bütiker from 2 years ago. In the setup, we have two quantum dots in the Coulomb blockade regime, so each dot either is empty or has a single electron on it. We have this charge conduct. These two dots are Coulomb coupled to each other, which means that they can exchange energy, but they cannot exchange particles. And we want to contact them in the fashion shown here. So our conduction dot up here is connected to two cold electronic reservoirs, while the gate dot down here is connected to a single hot reservoir. And our aim is now to drive a charge current through this upper dot just by having the temperature difference between the hot and the cold reservoirs. And it turns out that indeed you can drive this charge current up here if you meet two requirements. First of all, you obviously have to break the left-right symmetry of the problem, which you can easily achieve by making these two tunnel barriers differently transparent. Turns out this is not enough because there's also some underlying particle hole symmetry hidden in the problem, which you have to break. And the way to do this is by making the tunnel barriers here and here energy dependent. And this is actually something you get more or less for free, because tunneling through a barrier always depends on how far below the top of the barrier you are. So it's not really hard to meet these two requirements. And if these requirements are met, then indeed, as is shown here in this plot, which was calculated by this master equation approach that I introduced earlier, you get a finite charge current flowing through the upper dot as a function of the temperature difference between the hot and the cold reservoirs. And at the same time, you also see that then there are different heat currents flowing in and out of the different terminals. Now, how does this transport actually take place? This becomes clear by looking at the transport cycle here on the very right-hand side. Let's assume that initially our two dots are completely empty. Now, in a first step, we put in an electron in the upper quantum dot, say from the left-hand side. Then in the next step, we also add an electron into the lower quantum dot. In order to do this, we have to pay the charging energy, which we extract out of the hot reservoir. Then in the next step, the electron from the upper quantum dot tunnels out, say to the right, where we now release the charging energy into the cold reservoir. And then we go back to the initial completely empty state. And so in one such transport cycle, we transfer one quantum of energy, that's the charging energy, from the hot to the cold. And at the same time, if we tune our tunnel barriers the right way, we can also transfer exactly one quantum of charge, that's the electron, from the left to the right. And so in this sense, our device is really an optimal heat to charge current converter, because there's this proportionality between the electrical current and the heat current in the system. And as I will show you in the following, this has some very important consequences on the efficiency of our device. So, so far we just have driven a current through the system. In the next step, we actually want to generate some power. And the way to do this is to apply a bias voltage between the two cold terminals such that the heat-driven current now performs work against this bias voltage. And the power is then simply given by the product of current and voltage. And this power is plotted here as a function of the voltage. You see, without a voltage, there's clearly no power. Then it rises, takes a maximum, and finally drops down at the so-called stopping voltage, where the heat-driven current and the bias-driven current exactly compensate each other, so I is zero. And at half the stopping voltage, you see that we reach the maximal power. The other interesting quantity to look at is the efficiency, which is simply the ratio between the power that we get out and the heat that we put in. So it's simply power divided by the heat current out of the hot reservoir. And this efficiency is plotted here as these dashed lines as a function of the voltage. And what you can see is that at the stopping voltage, we reach Carnot efficiency. So that's obviously the best we can do. And this is, again, a direct consequence of this proportionality between heat and charge current. However, that's what I wanted to just say now. So you indeed get zero power here, and this is how it has to be, because if you reach Carnot efficiency, your device works adiabatically slow, so you take an infinite amount of time for creating a work, and therefore power is zero. And for this reason, the more interesting quantity to look at from an application point of view is probably the efficiency at maximum power. And this efficiency at maximum power is shown here as a function of the Carnot efficiency, or just the temperature difference that we apply. And you see that for our device, the efficiency at maximum power is given by half the Carnot efficiency, which in the linear response limit is also an upper bound. So there again, our device works as good as it just can.
Just a comment for the audience, that for people who want to have some details on all these thermodynamic considerations, the notes of last year on the web where these considerations were developed.
From an efficiency point of view, this quantum dot heat engine in the Coulomb blockade regime is really the optimal thing you can have. But if you now want to make some practical applications, it's probably still not the best thing to look at, because transport takes place by tunneling of single electrons. And so that's not enough to charge a cell phone. And for this reason, we asked ourselves, are there ways to generate larger currents and larger output powers? And one obvious way to do this is to go away from the Coulomb locate regime and to look at open quantum dots like these chaotic cavities shown here. So they are again capacitively coupled and in this three-terminal structure that we have just seen before. And now, instead of having tunnel barriers, we have the connection to our reservoirs via so-called quantum point contacts with a large number of open transport channels. And the main question that we want to address here is how do the current and the output power vary as we change the number n of open transport channels. And just as before, for this system to have some thermoelectric response, we need asymmetric transmissions here and here, and we also need some energy dependence, which we model as is shown here. So we write the transmission as a constant part T0, which scales linearly with a channel number n. And then we also have a correction that depends on the potential inside the cavity. And importantly, this factor T prime that occurs here is independent of the channel number because it basically describes the slope of the transmission with a channel number. For the system, we then used some semi-classical approximation involving some kinetic equation for the distribution function. I will skip all these technical details. If you're interested, you can take a look at the paper. And at the end of the day, we arrive at a rather compact expression for the current through our system, which is written down here. There are three main ingredients. First of all, there is something that we call the asymmetry parameter lambda. And this asymmetry parameter characterizes both the left-right asymmetry of the problem, as well as the breaking of particle hole symmetry, or simply the energy dependence of the transmission. So you see, if left and right contact have identical properties, lambda is zero, and if the energy dependence is zero, then lambda is also zero. So we need both of these things. Then the current also depends on the RC time of the cavity, which is determined both by the effective conductance of the whole double cavity, as well as by something we call the effective capacitance, which describes how strongly the two cavities are coupled to each other. And finally, the current is simply linearly in the temperature difference between the hot and the cold reservoirs. Now, if we analyze how this current scales with the number of channels, we find that it's independent of the channel number. And the reason for this is that simply for the thermoelectric response, only the partially occupied single channel is relevant. All the other completely open channels, they are just some background that has nothing to do with thermoelectrics. And then we can actually plug in some realistic values and we get an output current of 0.1 nanoamp, which is roughly two orders of magnitude larger than what you get in the Coulomb locate regime. And the reason for this difference is simply the difference between transport through a tunnel barrier and transport through a fully transmitted channel. We can then also calculate the power and the efficiency, and we find that power drops as 1 over channel number, and efficiency even drops as 1 over channel number squared. And the reason, again, is that all these open channels just are some background that does not do any thermoelectrics. And so if you plug in realistic parameters, you find that the output power is roughly the same that we get in the Coulomb locate regime, namely something like 1 femtowatt, and the efficiency drops down to just a few percent of the Carnot efficiency. So in terms of application, these chaotic cavities are probably still not the best thing to go for. But putting together the results that we obtained for the Coulomb locate and the open cavities, we get a hint where we should actually look at. And so here, to this end, I plotted the power of our quantum dot heat engine as a function of the conductance. And now you see that in the Coulomb locate regime, power just grows linearly with conductance, but then at some point you leave the Coulomb locate regime. Whereas on the other side, in the open regime, power just drops down as 1/conductance. So this naturally suggests that in between there is the optimal working point where we get the largest output power, and this should roughly occur for transport through a single channel. And one paradigmatic realization of this transport through a single channel is resonant tunneling through quantum dots, and so that's what we're going to look at in the next step. The system now looks as follows. In the middle, we have a small cavity which is connected to some heat reservoir, which is not shown on this picture, and this heat reservoir basically just injects heat to keep the cavity at a certain temperature TC. And now the cavity is then connected to a cold source and drain electrode via a quantum dot on each side, and the quantum dots both have one level that is relevant for transport, and these levels are characterized by the level position E left and E right, as well as by the level width gamma. And this level width gamma is relevant for two things. First of all, it describes how well the dot is connected to the reservoirs, but it also describes how large the energy window actually is in which the dot transmits electrons. So it characterizes how well the dot filters energy. Now this whole setup is basically consisting of non-interacting electrons only, so we can use scattering theory to describe it. And we've already seen these formulas in the morning. We can write down the charge current as transmission times the difference of Fermi functions. We can similarly write down energy currents by just adding an extra factor of energy here. And for our quantum dot, these transmission functions are simply Lorentzians characterized by the level position and the level width. And in addition, we also have the heat current that is injected from the hot reservoir, which I did not show on the picture. And with these ingredients, we can then write down the conservation of charge and energy in the form of these simple equations, which we can then solve in order to determine both the heat current J and the chemical potential of the cavity in a self-consistent way. And it turns out that for small level width, you can actually solve all of this in an analytic way, and you get results similar to what we had in the Coulomb blockade regime. But in general, for an arbitrary level width, you have to solve all of this numerically. And this is what we did. So first of all, we calculated the maximal power as a function of delta E, which is the difference between the level position of the left and the right quantum dot. And you see for small delta E, power grows quadratically, which is in agreement with analytical results that I did not show. Then we reach a maximum, and finally we drop down exponentially because for these large values of delta E, there are no more thermally excited electrons available to do transport. In the next step, you can then actually optimize all the parameters in our system. This is delta E, the level width, and the bias voltage that we apply in order to get the maximal power out of our heat engine. And these optimal values are then shown here as a function of delta T. You see that the level position and level width are roughly independent, and so we get optimal values of delta E equal to 6 kT and gamma equal to kT. So that's really in the regime where we have to do numerics and can't do any analytic approximation. And for these optimal values, the output power then takes this simple form, which means that for a temperature difference of 1 Kelvin, we get an output power of 0.1 picowatt, which is 2 orders of magnitude larger than what we get in the open quantum dots and the Coulomb blockade regime. So that's quite an advancement that we have here. At the same time, we can also look at the efficiency at maximum power, which is shown here. Again, roughly independent of delta T and given by 0.2 times the Carnot efficiency. So compared to the Coulomb blockade situation, we lose about a factor of 2. in efficiency, but that's of course more than compensated by the two orders of magnitude that you gain in output power. Still, 0.1 picowatt is a bit small to charge a cell phone, and so we wondered whether we can actually get still more power out of this. And the way to do this is by scaling things up in a highly parallel way by using self-assembled quantum dots. So now, here in red, we have again our hot cavity, and now on each side there are layers of self-assembled quantum dots embedded in an insulating matrix, and on the top and the bottom in blue we have the source and the drain. And this is what Andrew Jordan termed the Swiss cheese sandwich heat engine, because what happens now is that electrons tunnel through these quantum dots like through holes in a Swiss cheese, and importantly they tunnel through any quantum dot that is around there, so the positions of the quantum dots in the two layers do not have to match, which is why you can actually use self-assembled quantum dots. And then for dots that are 10 by 10 nanometers in size, we find that we can get an output power of 10 watt per square centimeter for a temperature difference of 10 Kelvin, so that's quite a lot. We then also investigated how robust these results are with respect to fluctuations of the level positions in the dots. And so in order to do this, we assumed that the levels are distributed according to a Gaussian distribution. And if there's a spread of 10% in the level positions, we find that the output power drops also by about 10%. So fortunately, there is a certain robustness with respect to fluctuations. More recently, we then also looked at a similar device where the quantum dots are replaced by quantum welds, and the results are roughly similar. We get a bit more power, but efficiency is slightly reduced, but for reasons of time, I will not go into this. Instead, in the last 5 minutes or so, I will talk about harvesting of bosons. And I will start with phonons. That's mostly work done in the group of Joe Imrie. And what they look at is some quantum dot or molecule shown here and here in brown, which is then connected to electronic reservoirs in pink and a phonon bath shown in green. And then using some linear response thermoelectrics and non-equilibrium Green's function, I won't go into details on this, they calculate the Seebeck coefficient, Peltier coefficient, and so on for these systems. And again, here they find that if they break left, right, and particle hole symmetry, then they can drive a charge current through the quantum dot just by having a temperature difference between the phonons and the electrons. Then they also looked at this structure here where we have an Aronov-Bohm ring with a quantum dot embedded. And for this system, they studied the flux dependence of the thermoelectric coefficients, which is interesting for itself because as soon as you break time reversal symmetry by this flux here, it turns out that the simple relation between the Peltier coefficient and the Seebeck coefficient that we've seen this morning in the lecture does not hold anymore. And in the extreme case, you could actually come up with a situation where you only have a Seebeck coefficient but no Peltier coefficient for a given magnetic field. Okay, so that's basically what I want to say about the phonons. We then also wondered whether we can use other types of bosons, because phonons are a little bit hard to control. I mean, they live in any material, and so coupling it only to the quantum dot might be a bit tricky. And what we came up with is a system where we want to harvest spin fluctuations or spin waves or magnons. So now we have our quantum dot connected to ferromagnetic metals and also coupled to a ferromagnetic insulator, which is a source of spin waves or magnons. And one motivation to look at this system was that it provides a bridge between energy harvesting thermoelectrics on the one hand and spin calorimetrics, where you drive and manipulate spin currents by heat on the other hand. And what we could show for this system is that depending on the magnetic configuration of these two leads, you can either drive a pure spin current in the parallel geometry, which means you have only spin flowing but no charge flowing. Whereas in the antiparallel configuration, you can drive a completely spin polarized charge current by the magnets. And finally, the most recent thermoelectric work that we have done is establishing a connection between thermoelectrics and circuit QED. So in circuit QED, you want to study the interplay between electronic transport and photons. And a typical structure that you look at is shown here. So you have mesoscopic conductors like these double quantum dots, and they are connected to a superconducting microwave cavity shown in this silver gray here. And actually, there have been some recent experiments both here in Paris in the group of Takis Kontos, but also in Zurich in the group of Andreas Wallraff, where people managed to establish this connection between a quantum dot and the cavity. Now, from a thermoelectric point of view, these systems are very interesting to look at because these cavities that you have in the experiments are really macroscopic in size. They can be centimeters long. So you can effectively separate the hot and the cold part of your system, and thereby you can completely forget about any leakage current of phonons that would otherwise flow from the hot to the cold part. So that's a system where you can really hope to see all these Carnot efficiency and so on. And the way how it works is schematically shown here on the right-hand side. On the hot side, you tunnel in preferably in the excited level, then you relax into the ground state by emitting a photon. The photon travels to the other end of your system, to the cold quantum dot. And now, importantly, at the cold side, you have some asymmetry because the levels are detuned in such a way that the ground state, say, lives more on the left-hand dot, while the excited state lives more on the right-hand dot. So what happens now is that electrons tunnel in from the left-hand side, absorb a photon to get into the excited state, and then they tunnel out to the right-hand side. And this way, you drive the charge current by having the temperature difference between the hot and the cold. And this brings me to the end of my talk. So after some general introduction to quantum dots and Coulomb blockade physics, I mainly focused on three-terminal thermoelectrics with quantum dots. First, I talked about Coulomb-coupled conductors. We have seen that in the Coulomb blockade regime, you get a high efficiency, but a small power. Then we had the open quantum dots that had small efficiency and small power, but pointed us towards a perfect system, which is resonant tunneling, where you have both very large output power in combination with a decent efficiency. And then towards the end of my talk, I also talked briefly about some boson-driven heat engines, where we have phonons, which personally I think are hard to control. Then we had the magnons, which make the bridge to spintronics. And finally, we had these microwave photon-based setups where we get in touch with circuit QED. And with this, I'd like to finish and thank you for your attention.